become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Actually, I never understood that, because really, lists that run 10 through 1, is they're really counting up, aren't they? Or is down? I don't, you know.
Well, but, I think okay. you have to look at it as like counting down to, well, you're right, I guess.
Yeah, but they're counting up in quality and moving up two positions, and yet they say, we're counting down. I don't get the whole thing.
I guess counting down is like a time thing. It's like counting down. You're down
right.
the time.
Right.
Yeah, you're counting down because you're losing it.
You're losing the time.
You're losing time, and as all of us, as we get older, we are losing that precious commodity to us. So,
but if you listen to like Casey Kasem's Top 40 or something, is he dead yet? By the way. Or is he still alive?
No,
I don't know.
I think he's still around.
Has he stopped counting down?
No. We're not counting down.
Top 40 in the sky, I don't think so.
If you listen to the top 40 and they're like, it was number 12 last week, and it's number 10 this week. It's up two notches. I mean, they're counting.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Casey Kasem was always counting up, actually. So it's true.
So should we introduce this to, to change this, because it should be you're counting up, not counting down.
I think so.
Okay.
I think the optimist in me wants to say counting up.
Okay, that's good. I'm for that.
Okay. So we're all joined tonight for a special count-up of our own individual top 10 favorite films of the 90s, as all lists. We get into the specificity of numbers and what they mean, and is this, sometimes it's really like splitting hairs. So, I mean, this is representative of 10 movies that we loved from the 90s and that we'll return to time and again, probably, I'm sure, for all of us. So I'll start. My number 10 is the first of two appearances of David Lynch. It's Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. Which I think is one of the most harrowing portraits of a tortured adolescent from that decade. I think it's the kind of the most searing character portrait he made in his career, and one of the great unsung performances from the lead in the movie. What can I think of her name? Cheryl Lee.
Cheryl Lee. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very powerful, visceral, and it's I've said it many times, and many other people have too, that it feels like a horror film. But for me, it's a horror film about the ugliest things imaginable: incest and abuse, and a death that almost serves as a salvation. That her life was so tortured that her death almost takes on an ethereal quality at the end. I think it found a very soulful conclusion to the kind of the Twin Peaks TV series phenomenon. I mean, it had its share of quirks in the movie,
mm-hmm.
And if Lynch had been allowed to film, had been allowed to keep all the extra stuff that he filmed from the screenplay, it would have been a lot jokier. So I think as it is now, the kind of the really dark tone of the movie, it works so beautifully, and it's consistent with the character and her journey. Because all the jokey stuff would have detracted from that, and it wouldn't have stayed with me as long. But they had big subplots where they go to something like Argentina or something, and there's a whole mess of other stuff that they were going to put in the screenplay, and that they were going to put in the final edit, and I'm glad they didn't. I don't understand every beat. I don't feel like I need to necessarily, but... And I will say the David Bowie scene is one of the oddest that Lynch's
it
even
is.
For Lynch's
it is.
That's an odd one.
Kudos to you for picking that.
I know a lot of people love that movie, and it was derided when it came out because people wanted the TV show, and they weren't quite ready to take it on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that a lot of people have come around to Firewalk with Me.
Well, I think that's because of our show. I think that's because of the Lynch tribute we had 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago. I think you really helped put that film out there on the forefront for a lot of people. Because a lot of people, you know, I think a lot of, you're absolutely right, people do, you know, because of the popularity of the TV show initially, that's what people wanted. But, you know, here Lynch gets to go where he's really at home on the big screen, and, you know, I'm surprised people didn't give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, when that came out.
Yeah, but people focus on the weirdness and that sort of thing, and there is a level of absurdity in all of his films, but what they miss in this one in particular, I think, is the deep soulfulness. Mm-hmm. You know, it is deeply felt when it comes to that lead character.
It has a lot of empathy for her.
Yes.
And what she's going through. And we've already talked about, a little bit about Cheryl Lee, but I think she's really this serious, MVP of this movie. I mean, she is absolutely superb in the movie. And, the show was unusual because the character that we were so interested in was not in the show, really. It was just in the show as an idea, you know, as a sort of springing point. But that movie is great. I mean, I'll tell you another thing. There's one scene in that movie that I really remember most. And by the way, the movie did make my top 100 list, but in the 90s, around 94 or something like that. But I really love that moment where she goes to that bar, and the music is so mixed, so incredibly loud, that I think they have to have subtitles in the movie in order to let you know what people are saying. And
which I think something that came up in post. That's indicative of a big strength with David Lynch in mm-hmm. his use of sound.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, no one has, the only director that has ever come close to replicating sound in a environment like that might be David Fincher when he did the scenes in
Social Network.
Social Network, you know. That is something that is just such a detail that's just so wonderful in that film. And the film is filled with wonderful details like that. So.
Mm. All right. Jerry, what's your first pick?
Okay. I have talked about this film in the past. I don't know if it was on this show. But it is by a wonderful director who is still making movies, and that would be 1992's Gas Food Lodging, Allison Anders. I watched this on videotape, I guess in the winter of 93, I want to say, when it first came on videotape. And I had never seen anything like it. Now, I have to tell you, it did sort of remind me of Desert Bloom and other movies from... movies from the 80s, but there's something about this movie that I just really felt it was very liberating, and I felt it was very informative because I just have not really seen anything quite like it, but I really liked her voice, Alexander's voice, and what she was willing to put out. And there are a couple of beautiful scenes in the movie between Ione Skye and Ferrazza Bulk. I mean, I think these are their best roles to an extent. I mean, really the richest characters they played. But I just thought for it was a great introduction. I know that if I'm not mistaken, Anders had done, is it, what is the, there's a Border Radio, is that the movie that she did?
Yeah.
Border Radio, and that's good, that's a good movie. I didn't see that until, like, Criterion released it a couple years ago. But I really enjoyed this, and I enjoy Alison Anders' work quite a bit. I was tempted to actually pick Sugartown over this. Or is that the one about the music scene in L.A., if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah.
Is it called
exactly.
Sugartown, or am I thinking?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Sugartown, yeah.
That's a great.
Mel Gibson's version was Sugar Tits.
I like that version, too, and I've seen that 15 times. But I like this movie. I think it's well done. It's a great coming-of-age story.
This was the apex of, you know, the indie film movement, where a lot of people were getting chances that normally would not have,
right.
Probably propelled by 89's Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yeah,
Soderbergh.
It comes with that, definitely. I mean,
yeah, and Alison Anders, I mean, she made some great movies, and she's still working. I'm sure it's probably with the changing climate, it's really difficult to finance projects. But, you know, we were talking about female directors not too long ago.
We were talking about females last week.
And Alison Anders is a great figure,
yeah.
From these early days of the indie movement in the 90s that came
mm-hmm.
out. But
we're
remiss to not mention Adrian Shelley, who sadly was killed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think of movies of, and these are movies of, from women about women that tell the woman story from an honest perspective. Adrian Shelley did as well. I mean, just her last movie, Waitress, was one of the most delightful movies I saw that year.
And she's an important figure, Adrian Shelley. I mean, thank you for mentioning her. I mean, Waitress is excellent. But, I mean, she was really like Hal Hartley's muse. And those mm-hmm. movies, The Unbelievable Truth and Trust. And you know, I think Hal, I like Hal Hartley. I like him more than probably most people. And I think his heyday was this period, this decade. The 90s really was his strong point where he, I think, did his very best work.
And Allison's on Facebook. She communicates.
Oh, I thought, yeah. I mean, she's very communicating. I mean, look even there's an interview today in the New York Times. De Niro says he and Scorsese have a hard time trying to get a movie. He says even for them it's a hard time getting a movie made. Imagine how hard it is for someone like Alison Anders to try to get something launched. I mean,
that's for sure.
I mean, so if those guys are willing to admit it, I, you know, think how hard it is for someone like Anders or something. And she continued to make really, in a very diverse movies. The follow-up to this is Mi Vida Loca. You know, completely not what you would expect.
Yeah.
But it's a very good movie. Then she did Grace in My Heart, then Sugartown, and I mean, just
I love Grace in My Heart. By the way,
that's a good little movie.
You know, it was we reminisce about the 70s, and they let the auteurs do what they wanted because they were so uncertain of what would sell, and you know, let the inmates run the asylum in a way. And for a brief period of time in the 90s, we had that again in this little subsection of filmmaking, you know. It was,
I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of heavenly in retrospect.
Yeah.
So, Dean, what's your first pick?
Life is Sweet is my number 10 pick. It's by Mike Leigh. It's from 1991. It's a British movie about a family, a middle-class family, like a lot of his movies. It's about a middle-class family living in the center of London. It's possibly his most uplifting movie, I would say. I mean, maybe with the exception of maybe like Topsy Turvy or something like that. But Life is Sweet is really, it's really not a, you know, it's wonderful in the sense that, you know, Alison Steadman plays a very, very, well, both Steadman and Broadbent play very, very effusive, wonderful parents. Like, these are the parents that you absolutely would love to have. You know, they're funny, they're fun, They're always, you know, they try to be as understanding as they possibly can be, but they're faced with Jane Horrocks as one of their daughters that is completely beyond understanding. Like, and that creates a lot of the drama that's in the movie. I mean, and we're talking about, like, there are moments in this movie where you're going from extremely high, like, just like, wow, this is the funniest movie I've ever seen, to like, oh my God, this is like, I can't even watch this anymore. Like, it's just too difficult to watch, you know. So it's like, it hits so many levels. It's got a beautiful score. It's like all of Mike Leigh's movies do, by the way. I think his the people who he has scoring the movies just do an amazing job of that. And it is a very difficult movie to see here in the U.S. because I still have my VHS copy of it, and I had that signed by Mike Leigh when I met him up in New York. But it's difficult to find here in the U.S., and I can understand why, you know, people listening to the show might say, where can I find this or whatever, you know. It's a difficult movie to find, and I don't understand why that is so. I mean, so to me, this is the movie that should be released on Criterion, like, immediately. But finally, I want to say that, you know, it's just an astounding emotional ride, this movie. And the other two awards that won from the National Society of Film Critics, which I should reiterate again, is the best critics association out there. I mean, always picks generally, I mean, like 98% of the time picks really what seriously is the best of the year. And they also picked Stedman as Best Actress and Jane Horrocks as Best Supporting Actress, and that's completely deserved. I hope that people out there can find a way to see Life is Sweet, because it really is one of the best. I mean, one of the best I've ever seen.
Pretty sweet. Jerry, what's your next one?
I don't even know if I have this on DVD. I know I have the VHS. The Usual Suspects.
Mm-hmm.
I love this movie for a lot of different reasons. But I went back to see it again with a friend after I went with my family. We went out to dinner. We went downtown to see it. I dragged everyone because I read about the movie in Film Threat. It was a limited release. And I was like, no, we got to go see this movie. No. I don't want to go see the Brothers McMullen. I'm sure it's a good film, but no, we're going to go see this movie. And it was. I like Ed Burns. I can relate to Ed Burns. He's made the same film over and over again, hoping that he can make it better. And I like that. I love Ed Burns. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you. But I really wanted to see The Usual Suspects. I'm like, this is going to be good. It's going to be awesome. If it's not, you guys can beat the shit out of me when we get out of the theater. Thankfully, it was good, because I would not have survived that. But I was just, I did not know who Bryan Singer was. I knew who Kevin Spacey was, obviously, from Wise Guy and obviously The Ref and things like that. I knew all the actors in the movie. And it was just incredible. It was a film that, like, really forced you to pay attention. It was really the old adage, you watch the movie, don't let the movie watch you. And it's a guy's movie. And what was the first of a series of guy's movies, because you get two really bigger movies at the end of the year that are all about guys at their best and worst. But this was just incredible. I thought at the time Bryan Singer at the time gave Tarantino a run for his money with this. It's just.
Did you? Because there was talk, similar talk involved in Mission Impossible, first Mission Impossible. Did you understand it?
I understood it, but it caught me off guard. You know, I didn't. You know, I had to go back and watch it again. Like I said, because I understood it though, but I didn't. I didn't catch all the clues and everything. If that's what you mean, when you mean understand,
well, I'm talking about kind of if you go through the machinations of plot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people complain, just as Mission Impossible, that there wasn't. It seemed confused at times. There wasn't a clarity in terms of.
I never understood that even about Mission Impossible, what people were talking about. I thought they were very...
Oh, come on. You can get that. I mean, I'm just talking about Mission Impossible now. I mean, like, that movie is kind of a mess. I don't know what's going on in that movie.
I mean, I'm not a big fan of the movie, but I do think it makes sense, though. I mean, I was really surprised.
Well, it might make sense on the second or third viewing.
No, I've
but,
only seen it the one time. I mean, I think it makes. I mean, it's a Mission Impossible film. Can I be?
So
very,
you don't require it to make any sense.
No, I don't think it's that complicated to begin with. I'm really disturbed when people at dinner who are Ivy League educated and work for the Clinton administration tell me they didn't understand it, and I'm like, great, you guys are in. And this is just, it's a Hollywood studio movie. It's based on a TV show. I don't think Mission Impossible is a complicated film. Now,
but they can make a movie like that too complicated for its own good. And,
but I don't
and especially,
think that one is.
Especially since they didn't have the script ready. I mean, they gave Robert Towne 2 weeks to do a rewrite, and he said, well, I can get it a little bit better, but we're not going to be all the way there. I mean, that was some of it that led to those rumors that it was
we've talked about this on the show before, this particular movie, Mission Impossible. I don't think – maybe it's just me, and I don't know, maybe because my friend tripped over the seats in front of him to try to get popcorn. I don't know. But, it just doesn't – Mission Impossible is not like, you know, Berlin Alexander plots. It doesn't really it made sense.
I mean, yeah. There's different kinds of challenges.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's not like Tarkovsky or something. But, no, going back to Usual Suspects, I mean, I got it. I think a lot of other younger filmmakers who saw that would go try to copy it. And it was the best, I think, of those movies with, if you want to say, the trick ending, I guess, or – it's by far the best of those. But it's just a great story, too. And it's a great crime movie and a great... And you really get to know each of the characters, I think, too. And you feel something for a lot of them. Gabriel Byrne, Benicio Del Toro. I mean, and I'll talk about Kevin Pollak. I mean, what a great performance from him. The one who became... Stephen Baldwin, the one who became the born-again Christian. I mean, they're all really... everyone's
yeah,
spot
well,
on.
It was a cornerstone for a touchstone for Kevin Spacey, obviously, too.
Oh, it's his movie, and Pete Postlewaite.
Good year for him. Yeah.
That was an awesome year for him.
Yeah,
that was
seven.
You couldn't ask for a better year. That was incredible.
I have to say about Usual Suspects, I have to like chime in on this. I'm one of the few people who dislike the movie incredibly, and I think one of my main reasons for disliking the movie is that since it's a trick-ending movie, and with all trick-ending movies, if you can guess the trick, then the movie loses something, you know. And for me, I guessed the trick like about a third of the way through the movie. I was like, well, obviously he's the guy. I mean, because he's telling the story, so he's the
best. Well, you know,
guy.
great movies hold up in repeat viewings. And by repeat viewings, you know what the trick is. So, I mean, the real trick of a movie
is
whether it holds up on a second watch.
Yeah, I think it holds up very well. And I think Bryan Singer is a fascinating filmmaker. Because he's never tried to make this kind of movie again. And I would welcome another crime movie from him again. But he got really wrapped up. We talked, you know, not to get too much off the subject, but he is one of the principal reasons why we have really good comic book adapted movies. His two X-Men, especially the second one, I think the second X-Men is a superb film. But he also is so good at that, he fumbled horribly with the Superman movie, but he's a fascinating, I can't wait to, he's obviously going back to X-Men, obviously, and I don't know if that's going to be good or bad. It's like Peter Jackson going back to the Lord of the Rings, I don't know. But it's just good, and also, let's not make light of the script. Christopher Farris' script is, I mean, we talk about Chinatown is one of the finest written scripts for the longest time. That was Chinatown is probably the finest, like, literature. And I will go to the ends of the earth to defend that. It really is.
It is.
And I think this is also a case. I mean, he was very lucky. He got an Oscar, Christopher McQuarrie, and his first film that he directed is a very underrated gem.
It put him on the map.
That?
And
Excuse me?
What is the movie that he directed?
The Way of the Gun.
The Way of the Gun, yeah. Which I liked even better. I actually liked better than The Usual Suspects.
It's a fantastic movie.
It put him on the map, and actually he's really building up a strong career as a director now. He is, speaking of Mission Impossible, he is Tom Cruise's pick for the next director of the fifth Mission Impossible.
I think that's a smart choice. I saw that too. I think that's a great choice. I have no qualms with that. I think he's...
Now,
yeah.
And now I got to say, I don't entirely disagree with Dean. When it comes to trick endings, that's the problem with trick ending, is that, you know, do they have an expiration date? Because once you know the trick, I mean, does it kind of not work after that point? And that's a big danger of doing those kinds of endings. I guess the big thing for me with The Usual Suspects was I didn't expect the movie to have a trick ending. I thought that maybe this mystery Sosa guy would turn up. I never considered that it would be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really dense when I watch movies. I mean, I really let the movie kind of happen to me in a way, and I recognize that. That being said, I always liked Usual Suspects. It was never something I was crazy about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that everyone around me was raving about it, and I thought it was okay. I couldn't tell you what was wrong with it necessarily. It just didn't really speak to me.
No, I understand that. But as far as trick endings go, I think this is one of the ones that does hold up. I can't go back and watch any of the M. Night Shyamalan films. I just don't because I think that's all. No, and I don't.
Are there any other trick ending movies that you can go back to and like enjoy?
If you can name.
Well, I can't think of any other than M. Night Shyamalan, but. How about Angel Heart? You know,
yeah.
Angel Heart is in a class by itself.
Oh.
I mean, come on, it's Mickey Rourke. It's De Niro as the devil, but it's Mickey Rourke. And have you ever read the book that's based on? It's a great
no.
book.
Uh-uh.
If you ever get a chance to read the book, it's a fantastic book. We're going to put Angel Heart in the
again,
category? Oh
I was not even thinking this must have a trick ending. He must be the guy. I mean, I don't think like that when I watch movies.
Even when you're watching
like something that has a mystery element to it, I mean, it's a detective and they're trying to figure out something, so you don't automatically
I don't try to figure the stuff out. I remember my acting teacher years ago saying, oh, that movie Sea of Love, I knew who the killer was as soon as he showed up. I said, really? In that one scene where they visit the post office, you knew that it was Michael Rooker? I said, that's complete bullshit. There's nothing to indicate.
Well, sometimes
we interviewed Michael Rooker. I would have said that, yes.
Well, sometimes it's all about the casting and just the way that the film is done, you know, like the scene that they appear in or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
there's something that happens now where
You're prepared for a trick ending, where, you know, there's so much stuff to read out there, there's so much social media stuff, they'll say, oh, I love the trick ending, so you're expecting it, so that's when I start to look for it and figure it out.
Got to stay away from social media.
Yeah. Dean, what is your next one?
My next one's from 1991. It's by Joel and Ethan Coen. It's called Barton Fink. It's one of the absolutely weirdest movies out there. It won the Palme d'Or that year, and it also hit the record books for also winning two other Cannes Film Festival awards. It won Best Actor for John Turturro in the title role, and also won Best Director for Coen Brothers. It tells the story of the title character, Barton Fink, who is a snooty East Coast playwright who gets invited out to Hollywood to write a wrestling picture of all things, and he absolutely doesn't know anything, even though he professes to know about the regular working man. When he gets the chance to do a movie about a regular working man that's not, you know, a fishmonger, but is actually a wrestler, he seems completely completely flummoxed.
Mm-hmm.
And he spends a lot of the time in the hotel that he checks into, the creepy hotel that he checks into, in his room, trying to figure out how to write this screenplay. But he actually gets it visited by his next door neighbor, played by John Goodman, who is a regular working man and is there to be a model for Barton Fink. But Barton Fink is too caught up in his own head. This is a movie about heads, by the way. I mean, there's heads all over this movie. I mean, there's mentions of, endless mentioning of, the mind and the brain.
We were talking about something else there for a second. Okay, thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah. So there's heads all over this movie, even in a little box that we never know what's in it, but we do know what's in it. So it's like the film is about, it was written by Joel and Ethan Coen at the time when they were trying to work on another film, and they got flummoxed by how to go forward with it, and they stopped working on it, on that screenplay, and then picked up Barton, started writing about a blocked writer. I think the film is really interesting in the sense that, well, first of all, it's one of the most well-crafted movies of the 90s. I mean, the costume design, set decoration, the photography, everything is superb. All the editing, everything in it is just absolutely astounding to look at. Plus, it has one of the greatest casts. Not only does it have John Turturro, who is superb in the title role, but it's also got Goodman and Judy Davis, Michael Lerner, who was nominated.
He's perfect in this. He's perfect in this movie.
Yeah, Michael Lerner, who was nominated for the Supporting Actor Oscar, playing the head of the studio. John Polito as his sort of sniveling toady. Then there's Tony Shalhoub as a sort of dyspeptic producer on the lot, and then there's John Mahoney as the sort of William Faulkner-esque kind of Southern writer who's sojourning in the land of the Philistines, as he says in the movie. The film just keeps giving and giving and giving. It's got this just crushing sort of atmosphere to it that just crushes you, and then it explodes into a finale that is just unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, the last 10 minutes of the movie is just fiery and literally fiery and incredibly there's just big question marks that appear over your head when the film finally ends with that incredible final shot, which is its own kind of trick ending that you could have not have ever had possibly seen coming. The last shot of the movie and the last line in the movie. It's just something that you couldn't. It's just like that's the perfect trick ending. You could never see it. You could never predict it.
A skewer of Hollywood beautifully in that movie. They really left no stone unturned there. I talk about John Goodman having a great year this year. He was just so incredible in that movie. I mean, he just good.
God.
Most of the things he's in, he does steal the movie. And I think he does a good job there. And obviously, as he did in Sea of Love or the year or 2 years before. It's a good movie. And I think it's also one of those things, those iconic performances from John Turturro. And it's, it's almost like a... And it's in some ways because of its weirdness. Weirdness isn't the right word, but there's a lot of odd qualities of the movie. It's a precursor to something like A Serious Man from the Coen brothers. Nearly 15 years later. And it has the same kind of rhythm to it. The geometry, almost, if you will. I think Barton Fink is a very good film. And it's also one of those films, because it came so shortly after Miller's Crossing, and how quick they work. I mean, they work at a ferocious rate when, you know, that's what I could not get over in the 90s. And even this, they just work at a very fast rate.
My number nine is a movie I saw in the movie theater 8 times.
Wow.
that is Martin Scorsese's Cape Fear. I hadn't seen a thriller quite like it, in that it was different for Scorsese, and yet in this genre that was new to him, he injected everything that felt personal to him. And some critics argued, I remember it was the first movie that I started cutting out reviews that other people had written and putting them in a notebook. And I remember one review, it could have been, I'm not sure if it was Rolling Stone, or probably not Rolling Stone, probably the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
The critic said that, he's imposing these themes on the movie, and the movie can't carry them. It's not designed to carry them. And those themes are stuff like guilt and, you know, the whole Scorsese Catholicism thing, the difference between man and Neanderthal caveman and all this kind of stuff. And it's made pretty explicit in this. Otherwise, this it's something that's designed to be a B-movie thriller, right at the end, to the end of it, when, you know, he stones De Niro to death, and then he's sitting there on shore like a caveman. Nick Nolte's character. I mean, sometimes it's very explicit, but it's about the moral lines that you cross and what that, how that can destroy your personal sense of integrity and your relationship with your family and your relationship with what you do for a living and how that can come back to haunt you. So it is truly like a psychological thriller. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all about the psychology. I thought that this was a great year for Nick Nolte in particular, between this and Prince of Tides, where, I mean, I had problems with Prince of Tides, but definitely not with his performance. Jessica Lange is one of my favorite actresses. I thought the movie had a very, very special, lurid look to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Freddie Francis did the cinematography to it, and I loved the look of it. I loved the kind of the operatic nature of the Avenger that comes to haunt the family and make the man pay for his sins, and you know, the over-the-topness of De Niro hiding under the car the whole time. And I remember every time I saw it in the theater, those 8 times, there was always a loud reaction to that shot of De Niro hanging underneath the car. Like, people started freaking out. And I love that he maintained the original theme. I mean, that even sounds like the approach of an avenging angel, that theme. And it even happens in the movie where they have De Niro walking right into the camera. I mean, you're like, eventually he's got to stop walking towards the camera, right? They said, no, man, he walks right into it.
He runs right into that camera.
He really does. Yeah, yeah. And you know, Juliette Lewis, and the scene that everybody talks about in that movie where De Niro comes on to an underage Juliette Lewis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
A very hypnotic kind of moment.
That's an amazing scene because it goes on for way longer than you expect a scene like that to keep going. I mean, it's like it appears in the middle of that film and you're like, okay, so they're just going to let this keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a brave directorial choice. I have to say that, you know, I was working at a theater in town that was showing that film when it came out, and I couldn't stop watching that film. I just loved it, and I'm kind of shocked to say that it's not in my top 100. Though I think I'm going to have to go back and actually change this.
so tightly edited too. I mean, just the crispness of the cutting is so wonderful in that movie. Yeah.
And all of the performances, even right down to, you know, Joe Don Baker, who's never been better, if you ask me. I mean, that whole scene, for me, that whole movie sort of like jumped into some other world when Joe Don Baker meets his demise in the film. The aftermath of that with I'm not going to say spoilers or whatever, because I'm assuming that people who listen to this show have seen this movie. But the whole thing with him, with Nolte coming down and then slipping in the blood and getting soaked in that blood, that was the most shocking thing in the movie, I thought. I was like, oh, my God, oh, no.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
Scorsese took the thriller genre and he shot it widescreen, first of all, which is unusual for a thriller, which is usually handled in a very claustrophobic manner with close-ups and such. He took a popular genre like the thriller. He played by those thriller rules, and yet the movie's entirely his.
It does say all of those things that you attribute to it. You know, the whole idea. You know, I think it's better than the original because it injects those notions of guilt and everything. Because in the original, Gregory Peck in the Nick Nolte role is just completely innocent. He hasn't had any kind of relationship with anybody outside of his marriage, and he I don't even remember in the original movie if he suppressed some kind of information in order to get a conviction, but in this particular film, they reveal that the Nolte character indeed did do this, so. It injects another sort of moral complexity into the film.
Yeah, it's not black and white.
No, it's not. It is not. I mean, actually, when you go back and take a look at the original film, which is still good because it really has a great performance from Robert Mitchum in the film, who actually appears in this movie, too, as in a way supporting role. But... And so Martin Balsam is in the movie too, which he played the Joe Don Baker role in the original film too. But the remake really deepens the story, like to a tremendous degree, and it is absolutely one of his best.
Good. I'm glad that there's agreement there. So, Dean, what is your next one?
Oh, okay. So my next one, number 8, would be the only film from this director in the entire decade. It came in 1999. It's Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. When I watched Eyes Wide Shut for the first time, it was, of course, after learning that Stanley Kubrick had passed away, and I had been invited to a screening of it by my employer. At the time, who was working at Turner Network Television, which was at that time connected to, and still is connected to, Warner Brothers. And so since it was a Warner Brothers movie, and she knew that I was a huge Stanley Kubrick fan, so she invited me to the film. And when I didn't know what to expect with Eyes Wide Shut. I don't think anybody did. That, I think... speaks to the strange critical reaction that it got, you know, which is not unlike any other critical reaction that greeted Stanley Kubrick upon the release of any of his other movies, too, which was everybody just was like, okay, so what is this or whatever, you know. But I think it's great that, you know, even now it's proving to be a movie that people go back to and are actually getting, just like they did with all his other movies. Tom Cruise, of course, plays a doctor in New York City who, after going to a party with his wife, played by his then wife, Nicole Kidman, goes to a party that's hosted by a client of his, played by Sidney Pollack. And he and Kidman both have a few little dalliances during the party with members of the opposite sex, and it becomes clear that they could have, you know, broken their marriage vows to one another during that party. But they decided against it later on. They have a after smoking a little pot, they have a kind of a snippy kind of argument about the nature of men and women, and this comes after, you know, asking what each of them did at the party. And at the culmination of this argument, there comes a moment where Tom Cruise gets a call from a client that says, we need you to come by. This is the moment that I believe is a moment in the movie where it switches from being in real life to into a dream world in which Tom Cruise is over and over repeatedly given the opportunity to cheat on his wife, but with a variety of different women, but it never really happens for him. It never really happens. And this goes into, you know, we get into the whole orgy sequence and so forth and so on. The movie is really about the trust that needs to be present in a marriage, and it's also about the sort of deception that also needs to be a sort of a component of a marriage, and the sort of communication that needs to go on between two people engaged in a marriage in order to keep that endeavor going. It's actually quite a beautiful movie, beautifully photographed by Larry Smith, who I know has been a guest on the show, and it's strange that it takes place during Christmas time, so it's like it's got all of these sort of dappled Christmas lights going all the way through it. It's just a movie that's just incredibly mysterious, and even
really
after you've watched it many times, it still remains, it keeps its mystery about it.
There's something very elusive about that movie, but hypnotic. I mean, it absolutely pulls you in every time, and you can't quite define how. But you can define, you know, what makes it human, which are all the points that you just brought up. But there's also some mystery about, you know, how he deals, like he did in every movie he did, with power, the corrosive nature of power. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong point of view about how women are treated by people in power. And there's also something weird in that when he goes on his journey, you know, he leaves the Sonata Cafe, for instance, and he takes a taxi to the costume shop so he could buy a costume for the masked orgy ball. When he knocks on the window, the reflection of the Sonata Cafe sign can be seen in that window. So essentially, he's taking a taxi across the street. So he's going in circles that night, for a bunch of that night, I think is what he's doing. I mean, it's one contained block that he's essentially traveling around.
It's true. That lends
the dreamlike quality, too, the kind of... where you can't, it's elusive, you can't define it. I know something's happening here. You know, it's very subtle.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who are confused by the film, I think, and I know, I from what I understand from, you know, interviews that I've read and heard from this show and so forth, that that Kubrick didn't really want it to seem like he was traveling in a dream world. Mm-hmm. But that remains kind of strange to me, and I think that's one of Kubrick's kind of sort of like he's trying to like get you off the trail a little bit because he doesn't want to have the movie explained. But the movie is based on a novel called Dream Novel by Arthur Schnitzler, who was a big proponent of
Freud,
Sigmund Freud's works and so forth. So the movie does have dream elements to it that are you can't deny. They're there, and you have to be you're forced to grapple with them. And I think
he probably didn't like defining it as a dream. Well, it's all supposition, really, because he wasn't alive to talk about it. But because you can dismiss everything with, oh, well, that's a dream. You know, that could be the all-in explanation for everything.
Well, I think that's exactly what he didn't want. And
yeah.
But I think that, you know, I mean, for those people who are clamoring for some kind of explanation for this film and for what happens in it, I think that if you look at it as just the sort of fever dream of a man that feels that his marriage is in trouble, that it's just been revealed to him that his wife had considered leaving him for another man, and if it would have worked out one smidgen of a way closer to, you know, that possibility, that it would have happened and the whole thing would have been over. And so this is his sort of fever dream about, well, how can I get back at her, or how can I, you know, what have I missed by being in this marriage and giving up a lot of experiences that I could have had. So I think it's an incredibly profound movie
in
many, many ways.
Okay, Jerry, what's your next?
I mean, you don't want me to chime in on Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah, please do.
Cut in any time, dude.
No, I'm not going to cut. I have some manners, not many, but some. You know, it's an interesting film. I don't know if I've seen it since it was released in theaters. I've listened to, like, everything we've said about the film, talked about it over, you know, with Kubrick and everything. I think it is the happiest of all of his endings. I think it's the only happy ending he has in any of his films, actually.
It's true, actually.
Excuse me?
I don't know. You can look at 2001 as being sort of a happy ending in some ways.
Kind of, but I would
that
think
baby's
this is
gonna
the most
come
positive.
To the earth,
I mean,
and blow
the last
up.
Line, the last line of the movie is the most optimistic thing I was uttered in movies. So, let's fuck. Well, that is
an incredible last line for a movie for a career.
And he was good at the last lines, though. He was very good at that. He was always very good at that last line. But it's a fascinating movie, but I think the one thing that's always left people until recently is that this was the last film he left us with, and we had to wait so long for this, and I can see why it was unsatisfying for a lot of people at the time. I think that's gotten, as you said, I do think the film is seen in a much better light these days.
I think so too, and the ones that still fail to embrace it do so because they don't believe it. What they're seeing is the last movie Kubrick left us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't believe this is Kubrick's movie as it should have been.
They're in denial.
It's a very different movie for him because it's a movie about personal relationships, which is different from just about anything else that he ever did.
Maybe
with the exception of Barry Lyndon and maybe Lolita, but
Lolita.
That's it.
My mom brought up a very good point about this when she watched it. She had said that nothing has really, his view of love, sex, and marriage has not changed at all since Lolita. And I thought that was a very telling comment. She actually thought the film could have been made in the 1950s or 60s, whenever. She thought that his opinions and thoughts on the subject had not changed at all. They were almost like frozen in time. She actually thought the movie could have been made 40 years ago.
Did she feel that, and I know your mom is a great commentator on movies, did she feel that the film displayed sort of a negative view of marriage? Because I don't feel that at all.
Someone who's been married for 53 years, trust me.
He was married for 40 years with the woman that he was still married with by the time he died. So, I mean,
he was
in a very happy marriage. So,
I don't associate happy with Kubrick in that sense. I think since none of us are married, and we witness marriages probably, we've been in relationships, but we know that everyone has their reasons for sticking together. Happiness is usually, I notice, on the bottom of the list. And having said that, I would have to go back and watch Lolita again. But I always thought that was a telling observation, that the movie could have easily been made.
Well, I think it's probably true, because, you know, honestly, from the beginning of time, human relationships have contained an aura of mystery to them.
Right.
And the male species hasn't figured out a lot about the female species those kind of human relationships, they're always those dynamics that are immortal. They'll last forever. I think there's a very positive way to look at this movie, though, and the relationship in this movie. There's a way to see that they're better off at the end of the movie because they've reached a point where they've broken down all the walls.
Right.
And they're ready to
accept,
you know, warts and all about the other.
They've broken down the walls. They're expanding their level of communication. And I think that makes it, and I agree, it makes it a very happy ending for the film.
And the whole scene with Dr. Ruth was cut out, where they go to sex therapy.
right.
Yeah. It's just they didn't have that, too. Yeah.
Okay, Jerry, your next choice.
Well, since we were talking about Scorsese earlier, I'm just going to name this one Goodfellas.
Of course.
Yeah. I kind of want to say Casino, but we did a whole show on Casino, and I love Casino. I thought it was a great how-to movie. It's an awesome how-to movie, actually. But Goodfellas, at its time, when Goodfellas is released, it is the first of a whole bunch of crime movies. The Craze, The Hot Spot, After Dark, My Sweet, The Grifters, and ultimately culminating with The Godfather Part III, the fairy tale of mob movies, the greatest fairy tale probably ever told. But Goodfellas was, at the time, even though we don't look at it this way anymore, this realistic, gritty, you know, anti-Godfather, very anti-Coppola, not in a bad way, just this anti-glamorization of the mob. Now, of course, as the movie's aged, it's anything but that. It is a total glamorization of the game.
It is. I mean, it is.
These
guys are movie stars.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as gritty as it thinks it is, but that's just age. But I think age has been very kind to it. That's another just great... You just like seeing Scorsese doing a gangster movie. It's just one of those things that you can never have too much of. Even if people thought, you know, that people unfairly criticized Casino as being a retread of Goodfellas, I don't think they're paying attention. But Goodfellas is just perfect. There's nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that movie. It's just a really cool, fun, timeless film. That isn't related to the antithesis of The Godfather at all. It's really not.
Great
performances by, like, Paul Sorvino. Every performance in the movie is golden. There's not a wasted performance in that movie.
No, because they're all, because everything in it feels so authentic.
Yeah,
I mean that's what I think about with the movie. That's a movie that feels lived in.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie where every detail was known very personally to Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a adrenaline to the movie,
mm-hmm.
but it also, I remember my boss when I used to manage a movie theater, and he said, I like Goodfellas up to a point, but then the ending was like such a downer, it died for me. And I said, well, that's really the point, because this movie really does pay attention to the exhilaration of being a gangster,
mm-hmm.
the camaraderie, and then the ultimate downfall. I mean, the ugliness of it, the drug addiction, the drunk on power, and having things go out of control, and losing your life, and
mm-hmm.
the sacrifices that choice of life makes. I mean, it really is the rise and fall.
What kind of ending
would your boss have wanted for that movie?
He was a film critic. But I said, you're absolutely right, and that's what's good about the film. If it had ended with, oh, life is great, I mean, what the hell was that movie saying?
Life did go great for Henry Hill, and he just passed away within the last year. But he became an artist, he wrote books, he was able to get out of the witness protection. I mean, he started showing himself, obviously, because all the guys who were after him were dying.
He was also a drunken bum till the day he died.
Right. I mean, it was interesting, because I also have to say that part of the appeal of the film, or the effect of the film, is that for at least someone like me, you read the papers, you read the obituaries, like, oh yeah, that guy, or yeah, that guy from Good, you would know all these people, all these mobsters, all these characters. You know, the thing is, I also remember when Robert De Niro said, when the movie came out, he goes, it's nice that the movie doesn't rest on me. I'm a supporting player. You know, I'm glad I'm not the main focal point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the movie, I think Goodfellas is like one of the most influential movies that's ever been made, and particularly of the past 20,
mm-hmm.
25 years. You see people even going so far as, like, let me just name two movies, one that's very good, Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, and also Ted Demme's Blow.
Yeah,
which I don't particularly care for, but they're both so ridiculously influenced by Goodfellas. Like, just the whole arc of Goodfellas, like how it goes up into a peak until the third act, and then comes crashing down. The costume design, the set decoration, the choice of music, which it has to be Scorsese's greatest. I mean, he's always been great at doing source music scores, but to me, his score for Goodfellas like goes into the stratosphere.
Right.
And I think it's something that he wasn't able to do, even though I like Casino. He tried to do it again with Casino, and it didn't quite work as well in Casino. But I think the reason that the source music score works so well with Goodfellas is there's such an expanse of time that's covered in Goodfellas, as opposed to Casino, which is really locale and really maybe like 5 or 6 years, you know. But Goodfellas goes over 2 decades. So there's this sense of time passing, and you learn it. You learn about time passing through the way the music is being portrayed in the film. You're so right, Jerry, that every single performance in the film is absolutely perfect, right down to just those guys that Henry Hill is going, the childhood Henry Hill is going in to visit at that, he says, he's remembering all of the people, and there was Jimmy Two Times that says everything two times,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all of those guys that he sees, every single one of them just look like absolutely perfect, you know. And the movie obviously had an incredible effect even into the 2000s on The Sopranos, because a lot of the people who are in the Goodfellas appeared in The Sopranos as well. So,
oh, big time.
Outside of The Godfather, you know, what is the only gangster movie that can give The Godfather a run for its money from the past 50 years, 40 years?
And
it's
that's
Goodfellas.
It.
That's it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
that's it.
Let me say that I'll go ahead and transpose two just to save time and say Goodfellas is my number eight, and now I'll reveal my number seven, which is The Insider, which, you know, I love Michael Mann. Obviously, I have a thing for Pacino. It didn't scream to me, this movie will be terribly exciting, about the ultimate whistleblower for the tobacco industry. And I looked at the running time, and, you know, 2.5 hours for a movie about a tobacco whistleblower, that seems like overkill. But the movie, it really is. But you know, when you're in the hands of a master director like Michael Mann,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the movie is so tactile and hypnotic and so uniquely done that I was completely engrossed. Because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, the newsman, I mean, Pacino felt like a newsman to me. And that world felt, talk about authenticity, that world felt very real and authentic to me.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating. The moral quandary of Russell Crowe, you know, and they didn't back away from showing the hot-headed nature of him. I mean, any other director under studio advisement, they'd be like, well, could you make him a little bit more likable?
I love that they didn't do that too, because
right.
that they kept that question going on in there, because it provided a sense of suspense in the film that might not have normally been there. You know, it was like, okay, should I be on this guy's side or should I not? You know, you never
quite leave his side.
But
what it also did, it keeps him from being the crusader. You know,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
his motivation for this could just come down to the fact that he's a major hothead and he doesn't want to be fucked with, you know
right.
which is different from I stand for a right and wrong. And, you know, it's more gray than that, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a beautiful film to look at. And Michael Mann's use of music
mm-hmm.
to set a mood.
Oh, my God.
Extraordinary.
That moment where they're going out to he and Al Pacino and the crew of lawyers are going out to give the deposition,
mm-hmm.
and there's that guitar music that's playing, like ding
yeah.
ding 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 ding. That thing, that moment is incredible to me. But just also that great moment too, where another car moment where Russell Crowe is in the back seat
mm-hmm.
being taken home, and he sees this car that's burning
on fire. Yeah,
and it's on fire. It's never explained. But that would have been another thing. Like, why would you? You know, the executives would be like, "Okay, what is this burning car here?" You know. It's never explained in the film, like, why is there this burning car or everything. It's just something there that gives you this feeling of impending doom, you know. And the film is filled with doom all the way
mm-hmm.
through it. I do love those scenes. I love how it cuts back and forth between the personal scenes with Crowe and his family. And then it feels very comfortable when they go into the boardroom scenes, not only with Crowe and the tobacco bigwigs, one of them played by Michael Gambon, or
Michael Gambon has one scene in that movie, and he's extraordinary.
Right. Yeah.
He's so great in that scene. But then I love also that incredible scene in the film where Gina Gershon comes up as a lawyer for CBS and reveals to the producers of 60 Minutes, what could happen to the entire network if they go forward with this story? And I think that might be my favorite, one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I mean, this is a great movie. Again, another movie from 1999. And you can go and I seriously have watched this movie, 20 times now.
And the characters,
and
more than
enjoy it because it
more
has
than, more than,
so much to love in it.
More than just the two lead characters have arcs. I mean, Christopher Plummer's Mike Wallace has a really interesting arc that I'm sure Mike Wallace, to his dying day, argues was not the fact of it. I think he was just uncomfortable with, what
being portrayed,
what the true story was. Yeah, but an extraordinary movie from a guy that was absolutely at the top of his game in this period of time. Oh my God!
I mean, the last of the Mohicans, Heat, and this one. I mean, and this Russell Crowe's performance is just out of this world. Incredible!
Oh yeah!
It is. It is. It really is. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I guess he had to gain a lot of weight. A lot of weight for the role, and if you think about it, the year after he won the Oscar for Gladiator, and of course he had to lose all that weight that he gained and actually bump up
back,
for
though.
That movie. And I personally still think that he won the award for Gladiator because they didn't give it to him for The Insider the year before, and they gave it to Kevin Spacey instead for American Beauty.
I think that's definitely a fair.
There's a lot of that performance. You can feel the anger and frustration. And just bottled up in this person, when that moment comes when Al Pacino calls him out on some of the things that that Crowe had not revealed to him about his past life, some of the lies that he had kept going for and everything. You're just like, God, leave this guy alone already. He's
right.
Trying to do the right thing. He's not a perfect person, but
I mean, you really do get a sense of the stress that a whistleblower is under.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I have to mention, another scene that I really love in The Insider, and this might be my favorite scene, and it's a great. The movie is great because another reason the movie is great is because it does not shy away. I mean, we've already mentioned a few of them, but it doesn't shy away from giving one great scene to one performer, and that's their only great scene that they have. And that scene with Bruce McGill as the lawyer that's fighting for Jeffrey Wygant, played by Russell Crowe, and he turns around and he's trying to get the deposition from him, and then he's getting a lot of flack from Wings Hauser as the opposing lawyer, and he just has this incredible scene that, if I could have given a supporting actor award to Bruce McGill for that year, I would have. Except
Amazing.
To say that it's his only really big scene in the movie, so it's like it'd be strange, but he is
not
so
really,
great.
But...
we remember him.
He has two or three scenes in the movie, but he really doesn't have a lot of lines in those other two scenes.
It is absolutely a surprising volcanic moment. And my all-time favorite Pacino performance is Dog Day Afternoon. I think that performance is perfection. My all-time favorite single moment is Pacino in this movie. And it's right after he gives his big monologue, and I've said this before, but it's when he looks to Mike Wallace for support and said, people like Mike and I, essentially we go after the truth of the story. We can't be afraid of the truth. And Mike Wallace says, Lowell, I'm with Don on this, meaning I'm not on your side. There's a moment where Pacino completely deflates. It's a silent physical moment, and I thought that is the most extraordinary piece of acting I've ever seen. That one moment was so amazing to me. I felt it so viscerally, and it's something that he's tried to recapture in the intervening years. I think he realized that that was a great moment for him, because he tries to do it again in Any Given Sunday when Cameron Diaz says, "You just got old." He does it sometimes in Merchant of Venice. He does it in Donnie Brasco. That kind of, I have the weight of the world on my shoulders, you know. It's a beautiful, beautiful moment. So people that are rewatching it or going to it for the first time, look out for that moment, I think.
Mm. He's great in the movie, too. I mean, but everybody is. I mean, every single person. That's number 38 on my list of the decade.
All right. All right, so Dean, give me your next one, which would be your number 7.
Well, my number 7 is a tie, and I told myself, I originally went with just one of these movies, but I said, this is stupid, I'm going to make it both of the movies. And that is John Lasseter's Toy Story and Toy Story 2. Toy Story was from 95, and the second part was from 99, yet another great 99 movie. I originally had Toy Story as my number 7 pick. Toy Story 2 is my number 7 pick. But I say, that's stupid. I'm going to put both of them in there because they can be talked about in the same breath. I think that they really work together as the same thing, as definite, you know, parts, two parts of the same story. So I said, okay, well, I'm just going to make it a tie. It has to be. Toy Story, of course, we know Toy Story, the Toy Story series, you know, changed cinema in many ways, and it certainly changed, moreover, it changed animated cinema to the point where now we don't, you know, as they were the first, you know, digitally 3D animated films, and now that's all we get. We don't have any more flat animation. It's very rare to see anything flat anymore. So, you know, obviously they're effective on that level. But it would be wrong just to say that that's their only effect. The big effect was their script writing and the casting. You know, nowadays when you see an animated film, it's inevitable that the cast of voices in an animated film is going to be, you know, tremendous. It's going to be as tremendous, maybe even more tremendous than the cast of any live-action movie could be, because, you know, the actors, you know, it's easier for the actors to collaborate together on an animated film, so you can get something like, I don't know, like Shark Tale that has... Well, it has Will Smith in it, but it also has Martin Scorsese in it as an actor in it. So, but the it's obvious that also that the casting in these two movies has been so effective that it has not only spawned a third movie, and who knows, probably a fourth and a fifth is in the future somewhere down the line. But also, you know, a bank of short films that, you know, at least 5 or 6 short films, you know, that have kept the same cast right down to, you know, Wallace Shawn as the dinosaur or Don Rickles as Mr. Potato Head or, Annie Ross as Bo Peep and so forth. So it's obvious that, you know, they did something right the first time. You know, they really got it perfect. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, let's talk about the story. The screenplay is so brilliant because it uses toys. I would have loved to have been, like, sitting in there while they, you know, in the Pixar, you know, boardroom or whatever, while they were coming up with the idea of Toy Story and Toy Story 2, the whole Toy Story, empire, because what they were doing was that they were commenting, you know, when they came up with this story, they were commenting on the fact that they were now adults working in an animation field. and they were having to reach out to children while still being adults. So they actually had to, they created Toy Story to actually make some kind of bridge between the adult world and the child's world. And this created a sort of philosophical they kind of delved into sort of a philosophical notion of what it was, what toys meant to us as children, and what they mean to us as adults. So that's another thing. Toy Story was all about what toys mean to children. Toy Story 2 was all about what toys mean to adults, and what why adults actually gravitate to collecting toys in order to recapture some part of their youth. And so this thing that initially seems like, oh, it's just a bunch of toys or whatever. No, it's not about that. It's about aging. It's about the very distinct stages that we go through in our lives and what these material things mean to us and how we infuse these material things with personalities of their own, which is another thing that the Toy Story series does, is it lets these toys actually display the personality that we wanted them to have all along. And that's just one of the many things that makes them great, you know. They each have incredible music by Randy Newman. And particularly I love Toy Story 2 a little bit more than Toy Story 1 because I liked that they kept it down to just one song that was in that movie, and it was just the most incredibly affecting song.
Yeah, if you're feeling sorry for yourself, I can't think of a song that that accentuates that emotion more than Sarah McLachlan's song in that movie.
Yeah, when She Loved Me is just, you know, if you're feeling even the tiniest bit sad or you want something to just wrench that out of you, that song in Toy Story 2 is going to do it. And not just the song, but the sequence that accompanies it, too. That sequence actually says everything about the Toy Story series. It really says it all right there in that 3 minutes, and that's why I like that film a little bit better than Toy Story. But it's wrong of me not to put them both together. I just think that they're lovely and great.
Good choice. Good choice.
Very good choice, yeah.
So, Jerry, what's your number 7?
We play the sound clip you have of me talking about this movie.
Is this it?
Spanking the Monkey.
Yeah.
I think Spanking the Monkey is very bold.
Is that it?
I wanted to save time, but yeah, I wanted to. I want to do this because, I mean, this guy made 3 really awesome movies that decade. I'd like to start with the first one, Spanking the Monkey. Are you just going to play that all over and over again?
I'll edit
no, why I like this movie, though, I at least. And maybe Jeremy Davis got typecast after this, between this and the...
God, what a thing to be typecast for.
But, you know, more so than anything, I just, like, and I don't know if he could make the same film today, or maybe he could. We'll find out in a couple of days with the Silver Linings Playbook. But I like that the main character, at the end, just leaves. I've always been struck by that. You know, he gets in the truck, he leaves. I mean, he just goes away. He's his family. I mean, he's at the height of dysfunctional families, as far as I'm concerned. But he, you know, has an affair with Mom, and he's not doing very well in life. He's having his troubles, and I've always liked that the end, and this is something no one could get about me after a while. I just really liked that he was able just to walk away, just leave. It's very much, you know, we talk about 5 Easy Pieces. Mm-hmm. Very much a character like Jack Nicholson in 5 Easy Pieces. Very much that kind of mindset. I would, and you must forgive me. I haven't revisited the film. I have the script somewhere around here, but I haven't revisited the film in a very long time. I mean, I don't think I need to. I just, as long as my that sound clip is available, that you have of me saying that, I don't think we need to revisit the film. I think that sound clip says everything. I love Spanky the Monkey. But,
he's an interesting filmmaker, and he really did. That was his debut film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big step. That was a big stepping out.
Mm-hmm.
a movie like that, and I don't think he's made. I mean, I cared a little less for I Heart Huckabees, but outside of that, I don't think he's made a movie that hasn't worked for me.
Well, I'm just curious. It is I Heart Huckabees is, you know, remember when it came out, it was a very divisive film on the film festival circuit. You either loved it or you hated it, kind of thing. So you're not alone in that. I mean, a lot of people. I think I like the soundtrack better than the actual film, but. The film has some good points, but it doesn't. It's missing something. It's a weird follow-up from something as brilliant as Three Kings, which was way ahead of its time.
It just seems, you know, I Heart Huckabees just seems like it's. I think that I Heart Huckabees is you know kind of you know exploring a. It's obviously exploring a philosophical point that a lot of people don't believe in. So that would probably keep a lot of people from looking at it. You know, a lot of people don't believe that we're all connected, that, you know, everything's connected in the world, that we're not really separate entities, that we're all, you know. So that's too big of a thing for people to get. Plus, the movie has it has this sort of wacky sensibility to it that throws a lot of people off.
It does. It's a good movie. Don't get me wrong. It's a good movie. I would love to have been a fly on the wall, obviously, while making it. But he's an interesting filmmaker. I mean, he really has made, like, a lot of different kind of movies.
He has.
And that's fascinating. But I just thought this was a good movie. You know, once again, like Gas, Food, Lodging, you know, very good coming-of-age story. It's a great little movie. Now, what do you guys think of Flirting with Disaster?
I'm a huge fan. I mean, I have both Flirting with Disaster and Three Kings on my top 100, but they don't have I don't have Spanking the Monkey. I think mainly because not because I don't like it, but just because I really haven't gone back to take a look
right,
at.
Right, no,
it
I understand.
For a really
I mean,
long
a
time.
Lot of these I haven't gone back to take a look at. I love Flirting with Disaster too.
I like it too. You know what though? I'm curious because I mean, he got With Lily Tomlin and I Heart Huckabees, and before that with George Clooney and Three Kings, being very vocal that he wasn't going to work with Russell again.
Mm-hmm.
So he got a public spanking. And looking at his last one, The Fighter, and reading a lot of... I was supposed to go to a screening the other night for Silver Linings, and I couldn't make it, but reading about that movie. I mean, he seems to have attained this kind of generosity of humanity.
Right.
In these past two titles, that is a lot more pronounced than in previous movies that he did.
Right, I can give a fair assessment.
It's interesting, you know. I think that he has I'm not talking about him like as you know how he works or personally or whatever, but like I think that he has a really effusive kind of feeling for humanity in all of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really easy for me to see a lot of meanness in a lot of the indie movies from the 90s and even the 2000s. But I don't feel a lot of meanness in his movies. I feel that they're very fair to every one of each of their characters, and now that he's moved in more into the mainstream, I think that's become even more so now. And I understand that's the same way with Silver Linings Playbook. I love his sense of he has an overarching kind of sense of fun about all of his films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a real, I mean, with maybe maybe a little bit less in Spanking the Monkey, but even so, that movie is extremely funny in a lot of moments.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't shy away from expressing in the same scene both a sense of joyous sort of hilarity and also like a kind of like wincing kind of I can't stay in this room any longer. I gotta
right.
get out of here.
Yeah, there.
So
there
like,
I mean, what he has a hard edge to him, but I think as of late he's found like this really strong empathetic tone.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just the prospect of getting older. Maybe it's I don't know when he had his child, but he is a father.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, I think, who's young, was in The Fighter, like one of the opening scenes of The Fighter. So I think maybe it comes with being a recent parent. I don't know. But I sense it in him. Dean, was your number 7 Toy Story 1 and 2, right? Okay, so we're up to number 6. So I'll say my number 6, speaking of twist endings, knowing the twist of this one only deepens your appreciation of it, and that is David Fincher's 7.
Mm-hmm.
7 is my number 6.
Ah.
Sorry, I couldn't put it at number 7. That would have been good.
That would have been little too precious, I think.
Yeah, I do adore this movie. And I remember my acting teachers watching it and saying, it was just, it's a typical serial killer movie. And I said, well, I like it because
far from
it's the exact opposite.
I think it's the best serial killer movie.
Oh, and if you think of the tropes of the serial killer movie, it turns almost every one of them on their head.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that it maintains, that he's the wizened cop near retirement and he's the hothead new recruit that's
mm-hmm.
partnered up with him, it makes it human. It makes it believable.
Right.
They are very realistically and naturally motivated by their placement in life, where they are in their lives.
Yeah.
And the repercussions that are suffered by Brad Pitt are a direct result of where he is in life.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of the hothead, hotshot. Beautiful chemistry between the two of them. The most the most gorgeous, ugly cinematography you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. That Darius Kanji cinematography is just absolutely superb. I think that that's one of the things that just tumbles this movie over into, like, unbelievable greatness. You know,
yeah.
It's just that and also just the design of it, the set design, when you finally make your way into John Doe's apartment, you're like, what? And then, but also, let's not forget the incredible credit sequence by Kyle Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That really sets the pace. I mean, it has to be considered one of the top 10 greatest credit sequences ever, maybe top 5. It just really, when I saw this movie, I didn't have any expectation because we didn't really know who David Fincher was at the time. But when I saw that credit sequence, I was like, oh, my God. And then I learned it was Kyle Cooper. But, still, it's a David Fincher choice to have Kyle mm-hmm. Cooper do this. And it was an incredibly wise choice. And they obviously worked closely together to put it together. And it's amazing in that credit sequence how much that credit sequence actually reveals to you.
Mm-hmm.
So many details of what's to come, And again, another twist. It was great that the movie came out before the internet became huge.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh, yeah.
When you're sitting there watching that movie and you're like, tra-la-la, then all of a sudden Kevin Spacey pops up, your guts just fell out of your
mm-hmm.
out of your body watching
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. The killer turns himself in halfway through it.
Yeah.
Just wondering, where the hell is
this
movie going?
How is that a traditional serial killer movie? When you're the person said, like you said, it turns it all on its head. If you want, the traditional serial killer movie came out a couple weeks later, Copycat. But
yeah. Exactly.
But, that's what a really terrifying thing. You think about the movie, as Fincher, some Fincher movies, you do think that they leave a mark on you. If he doesn't turn himself in, well, good luck, guys. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Well, and,
exactly.
And it really, I mean, these cops in the movie, they are true characters, and it's one of those instances where every piece of the puzzle serves the whole. You know, everything is organic to
mm-hmm.
what that movie's trying to express. So
mm-hmm.
the visuals absolutely deepen the themes of that movie. They're working
right.
in perfect concert with each
right.
other. Right.
Go ahead. I mean, I was just going to say that. One of the things I love about it, too, is that once you finally meet and talk to, hear John Doe expressing his views on
mm-hmm.
the world, I think that it puts the audience in an interesting position because it's not, his views on the world are not really that different from the views that any one of us might have.
It's interesting, sort of to a lesser extent, somewhat of the interview scene in Natural Born Killers a couple of years before between Woody Harrelson and Robert Downey Jr. There's some of that thought process there. But then you could also say he's, you know, that's what a lot of people, not a lot, but some people said after reading the Unabomber's manifesto, Ted Kaczynski, was that, wow, some of this makes sense. Not his methods about going about it were not right, but when you read the text of what he was saying. So I think it's very important, you know, if this is the right word, humanize Kevin Spacey in those scenes.
He does. He doesn't make him a crazy nut, you know, like
no.
the kind of crazy nut that they were, that Pitt and Freeman were expecting, you know, like. There's a great line in the movie. I just want to say this. There's that great line in the movie where if the devil pops out of John Doe's head, I won't be surprised or whatever. Something like that.
But that's what's great because, especially in that scene where John Doe has his big monologue in the back of the police car,
mm-hmm.
It's the reaction of both of them to him.
Right.
That Brad Pitt will not have any of it. Brad Pitt does not get it. Nothing's getting through. Morgan Freeman knows he has something planned. I mean, this is planned, and we're pawns in this.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this kind of deep sense of inevitability in Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman is a character that actually shares some of these views
yes.
that John Doe has. This is why he wants to get out of the business. He's tired of it because it's scarred him as to his view of humanity. And when Morgan Freeman gets there's that wonderful, let's don't forget Gwyneth Paltrow in the movie, who has a few great scenes in it. His relationship with Gwyneth Paltrow seems to, and I'm talking about Freeman's relationship, seems to sort of reawaken some sort of love of humanity in him, and that makes the ultimate ending, you know, just so much more tragic, just not for Pitt, but also for Freeman as well. You know, that's one of the great things about the movie is that you know, there's not that the gulf between, you know, the detective, you know, the lead detective detecting on this thing and person that he's after is not really that wide, you know. And meanwhile, you know, Brad Pitt is kind of just playing at being a TV cop, you know. He's like,
mm-hmm.
he's doing all the things that he's seen on TV, you know.
But he doesn't let it inside, as Morgan Freeman has.
Mm-hmm.
And so so Brad Pitt pays the ultimate price at the end of it, and he understands
right.
by the end of it. I'm sure.
We did a great
mm-hmm.
show about this movie a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we brought on one of the producers, and yeah, it was interesting. Okay, that was my number six, so now we got to do you guys' number six, and then
mm-hmm.
we're done for the night. So, Jerry, what's your number six?
We talked about it earlier, Boogie Nights. And I've talked about it, I think, on those top 20, our favorite films of the last 20 years. I think Boogie Nights was one of them. You'll forgive me. I don't remember. It was a little over 3 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
But,
yeah.
It was a good, really. I mean, that was a great weekend. I went to go see Boogie Nights and then the Ice Storm. So that was a great, great week.
Oh, I love the Ice Storm.
I like Boogie Nights. There's another case, you know, a director who had three incredible films this decade, Hard Eight and then Magnolia at the end of the year, at the end of the decade. But Boogie Nights was just, it's intoxicating, like Goodfellas. Like a lot of Altman films, like Shortcuts, like Nashville. There's something very intoxicating about a Paul Thomas Anderson film. But here he manages, like Altman, he can juggle all these different storyline, all these different characters, and he makes it work. He has never not made it work. Like Altman before him, everything comes together. Everything's very, I don't know how he does it, but he makes it work. And he does which is the definitive movie on the golden age of pornography. Even though it's not real, you know, it's not accurate according to a lot of people. It is, when you think of this era, this is what you think of. You're talking about Goodfellas, right? The beginning's all nice and everything, and then the end, the drugs and everything. Wow, you get it here. And oh god,
interesting casting. I mean, there's
casting.
There's a case to be made that Mark Wahlberg's never been better. You know, I like Mark Wahlberg.
That's true. You look at Three Kings. You look at
The Fighter.
He's
done great work. But this movie really, that character really goes on a ride, you know? I mean, the character has a major arc. And, of course, Burt Reynolds, who, you know, I adored
yeah.
in the movie.
He's great. You know, there's a lot of great, you know, you go back, we did a show on this one, too, on a great...
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Who's hysterical in the movie?
Yeah,
I mean he's really great in that film.
Oh, he is. He's kind of faint. You know, in movies you see like A Late Quartet, or you see shades of that character. His quirks come out, or in Jack Goes Boating, you see those quirks still from Boogie Nights come out. I don't think you see it in The Master. I could be wrong, but
Philip Seymour Hoffman came into prominence, or the first time I remember seeing him was Scent of a Woman. And Boogie Nights is decidedly a different character than that.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure he played it very tragically, that he's in love with
Dirk Bickler. It's that scene, and you have I don't know about you, but you have an inkling it's coming. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I mean, you know it is, but you're just like, wow.
when he's trembling every time he's holding the boom,
Oh my God, yeah.
His belly like hanging out of his shirt. His shirt's too short for his bones.
And we talk about, I mean, something's very important here. You talk about Scorsese's use of music. We talk about Kubrick's use of music. We don't always talk about Anderson's use of music, because the last three films really had John Byron for Punch Drunk Love, and then for The Master and There'll Be Blood, he has Johnny Greenwood. He's had these incredible scores, but his use of or Amy Mann for Magnolia, but his use of the songs of the period. I mean, it's two soundtracks, if I'm not mistaken. There was one in Volume Two. Volume One, which got worn out on cassette tape, but great choices of music. I mean, really, and I would dare to say, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. It's just one of the iconic
music. Brand new key.
Yeah, I mean,
brand new key, my melody.
It's just great,
yeah,
great. You don't, when you hear that song, you think of Roller Girl. You don't think of anything else.
I love that that use of that. Crazy version of Beethoven's Ode to Joy that's done in it, which was a top 10 hit in the 70s. I just want to read something that I had to say about Boogie Nights I did on my my website, Filmability. I still find many moments in Boogie Nights to be quite wonderful. The widescreen cinematography by Anderson Regular Robert Elswit is always vibrant and inventive, as is the diverse 70s-era source music score, which pairs nicely with that sort of sad circus-flavored underscore by Michael Penn. Anderson writes dialogue for dumb people particularly brilliantly, so there's always funny conversation ensuing. And the period detail and the garish art direction by Bob Zembecki and costume design by Mark Bridges, who's gone on to do The Fighter and The Artist, he won the Oscar for The Artist, is absolutely spot on. I love seeing Burt Reynolds tearing into a meaty role for possibly the last time, and Julianne Moore is beautifully histrionic, as she would be in Anderson's Magnolia as well, and both she and Reynolds receive supporting player Oscar nominations. And as always, I find John C. Reilly to be a hoot. In this, he plays Reed Rothschild, Dirk Diggler's, you know, cohort or whatever in porn and in life. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is great. It's sort of sweetly doofy as the crewman who gets a crush on Eddie. And that tortured confession, I think, is the movie's most shattering scene. But I have to say this, I also find many parts of the movie don't work. William H. Macy is kind of shamelessly barely sketched punching bag of a character, and Don Cheadle's story fails to make a deep impression. And by the way, I want to note, anytime you see a character in a white suit, you can bet that thing's going to be covered in blood by the end of the scene. And Graham's roller girl, while being extremely cute, also seems a little thinly written. It feels like, for me, it feels like Anderson just has too much movie here for 2.5 hours to hold. I think Boogie Nights would have been a much better TV series or a miniseries. Also, the film owes a bit too much to the Goodfellas style of soaring and then crashing storytelling, with the onslaught of the 80s being a rather too obvious turning point, though thankfully the AIDS virus doesn't even make a cameo appearance. But that said, the movie is required viewing if only for its extremely tense final third, which finds Eddie struggling with a cocaine addiction while trying to launch a hilariously ill-thought musical career. And, of course, there's that scene with Wahlberg and Riley and Thomas Jane stuck inside the coke dealer's house, played by Alfred Molina. And you'll just never listen to Jesse's Girl or Sister Christian the same way ever again. I mean, it's
Sister Christian, man.
Yeah,
the use of that movie. Yeah. It is inspired music, and it really is the birth child of Altman and Scorsese. I mean, that movie in particular is for Anderson, I think. And I prefer too much movie over too less.
Yeah, I gotta say, and I wanna just, I don't think any filmmaker has ever made the San Fernando Valley look so beautiful. I mean, and I don't mean that as a snarky, cynical. I mean, yes, the valley is. I mean, how many thousands of porn films take place in the valley or filmed in someone's backyard or swimming pool? But who has actually made the valley look beautiful? And it is not beautiful. I would move there tomorrow if given the opportunity. But he the valley became his playground, really, to tell some of his stories, Anderson. And while I agree with Jamie 100%, I'd rather have too much movie than too little. And I would welcome a 5-hour director's cut of Boogie Nights. I would go buy that right now.
I think I would like it better. It might be it's a positive to say that I wish that it was longer, you know? I mean,
right.
I do.
But I walked out inspired. I walked out, I felt good about life when I walked out of that film.
It is an invigorating movie.
Yeah, it is.
Feel after a lot of Tarantino films.
Yes, exactly. I think we talked about it when we did our favorite directors. I said that about Tarantino mentioned, but this is just otherworldly. And it also, unfortunately, is the first of all Paul Thomas and Anderson films. It does great in limited release, and when it goes wide, it dies. which is always unfortunately he's just not, how do we say this, he's just not for all of America. He's just
I think that
America's fault. He's just not telling. He is talking about his view and the way he sees things is just never going to be mainstream. It's just not, unfortunately.
Right.
And there's nothing you can do about that at this point. With the films he has under his belt. I mean, he gave Adam Sandler his greatest performance, and people didn't go for it.
Yeah, isn't that amazing that, like, you know, as big as Adam Sandler is, you know, this is the one movie they stayed away from.
It's
it's crazy, you know. I just
so, Dean, what is your number six?
My number six is the only Best Picture Oscar winner that appears in my top ten. It's from 1992, and it's Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven.
Mm.
This is a movie that came at a point in Clint Eastwood's career where, you know, he literally hadn't been in the saddle for a long time. I'm talking about Westerns. I think the last Western that he had done previous to this was Pale Rider, which was in the mid-80s. And
85,
that wasn't,
I think, yeah.
Yeah, and that wasn't so great. So when I heard that Unforgiven was coming out and it was finally going to be a return to the Western, I was extremely excited about it, even more excited than I had been for some of his, you know, other directorial movies. Like, you know, I mean, he, previous to Unforgiven, he had done, you know, White Hunter, Black Heart,
mm-hmm.
and I don't even think I had seen that at this point when Unforgiven came out. And then I think I went back and checked that out and saw how great that was. But I don't know, when Unforgiven came out, I just had this sort of like weird kind of like, well, I've talked about on some Oscar shows about how I have like a little bell that goes off when in my head when I see that see the Oscar winner for the year or whatever, you know, whether it's a trailer for it or the actual movie or whatever, but a little bell goes off. And I didn't even have to see the trailer for Unforgiven for the bell to go off for me. I was like, hey, it's about time that Clint Eastwood, you know, came up with something really, really great. That said, you know, I mean, it did end up winning Best Picture and Best Supporting Actor for Gene Hackman, and director for Eastwood, and I think it won Best Editing as well for Joel Cox. It only won 4 awards out of 8. But I really think that David Webb Peoples' screenplay should have won that year too. But this film has such a feeling of like an overwhelming feeling of loss to it. It's really a movie about it's a movie about people who are liars, first of all. Almost every one of the characters in the movie is a liar in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Morgan Freeman is lying about his own abilities. The Schofield kid, is lying about his ability to see. Clint Eastwood's character is lying about how he's not that kind of man anymore, even though he really is. It just takes the drink, takes the liquor to get it out of him. The women who have contracted for this killer to come in to take revenge on a man who had cut up one of their fellow whores or whatever, not to use that word for them, but that's what they were. You know, they're lying too. They have to lie in order to get this, you know, this thing out there. Gene Hackman is lying about his supposed good nature, but actually he's not a good man at all. He's a villain that's just just has a badge on. That's the only difference, you know. So everybody in this movie is lying in some way. So that's an interesting thing. But everybody also, everybody in the movie is feeling some sort of sense of loss. And, of course, chief among those is Clint Eastwood's character who found redemption in the love of a woman and who he had kids with, but the woman is gone now. And he's rudderless without her in his life. And so it makes it very easy for him to actually drift back into the behavior that he had indulged in earlier in his life. And so I don't know. The movie is just filled with that sense, that sort of like impending, sort of like overwhelming darkness. In fact, like a lot of Clint Eastwood's movies, it has this sense of like incredible blackness to it. You know, Eastwood loves to film in very dark shades, and so this is no different. But also, this movie also has this sort of like overwhelming beauty to it too. This sort of first of all, there's never been a Best Picture winner like it. Let me just say that right now. It has to be the darkest, and I mean like emotionally darkest movie to ever win Best Picture. But also, you know, I always remember the way the movie begins and ends with that beautifully worded scroll that comes up that tells you at the beginning, you know, who William Money is, and then at the end, what actually happened to William Money, or what was rumored to have happened to him. And then you, with those two scenes, with that incredible music that I think Eastwood actually wrote that backs both of those scenes. With those scenes, you really get a sense of what the man could have been, and actually what he really was. I just think that's beautiful. I think the movie is absolutely extraordinary. You know,
and it really, I mean, Clint Eastwood is as an actor in westerns, he built a career on creating the mythic. And actually, I mean, his, like you said, Pale Rider in 85, his previous Western, I mean, it was nothing if not mythic. I mean, you didn't even know if that character was human or if he was some kind of avenging apparition. So I think that Unforgiven is a great flip side of that. And that's why it feels like the perfect kind of final word on the Western. Where could he possibly go with a Western after that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the deepest sentiment that he can make about the genre.
It is the meeting. You're right. It is the meeting of the mythic with the real with that movie. It's like, I think that's another thing that those bookends that I was talking about actually do. You know, it's filled with great performances all the way through Richard Harris and as English Bob and Saul Rubinek as his writerly counterpart and you know, of course, Gene Hackman is superb in it, but there's also people like Anthony James as the owner of the billiard parlor who's great in it, and all the women that are in it, including Frances Farmer, they're all terrific in it. So it's very economical. It's 2 hours long, but it feels like it really feels like a novel on film in some ways. You know, it really feels like the greatest novel that you've ever seen.
Well, it is very
economical,
and I think that the movie really benefits from Clint Eastwood likes simplicity.
Yeah,
and that translates to the performances as well. I mean, you think of and I've probably said this before about Gene Hackman in that film, but I think that Gene Hackman won that Oscar because of his scene with Morgan Freeman, where he's beating Morgan Freeman, and he says, you know, if your answers don't match up with their answers, then I'm going to hurt you real bad. There's a way that the typical way to play that, which is more broadly, more menacing. He plays it almost saying that in a whisper to his ear, like he's telling him, you know, sweet nothings in his ear or something. And it's all the more menacing for it. I mean, it's a very simple decision that he makes that's so great. And also, its approach to violence. Violence in this movie, and I think this is why a lot of hardcore Eastwood fans of old resisted Unforgiven, of the older generation I'm talking about, because they were expecting a Western to shoot 'em up, you know? And this does have that shoot 'em up quality, but you see the ugliness and the senselessness of the violence.
Right.
I mean, he goes in, he kills Bill, he kills everyone in the bar, he walks out, what's the first thing he sees? Morgan Freeman's dead body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't mean anything. There can be no closure to this. It's ugly. It's haunting. And that movie pays service to that.
Well, again, back to the mythic, too. The movie is also really about the breaking down of myth. I mean, and that's the whole Saul Rubinek character, the reason that he's in there, because he's making a living
creating it,
escalating this guy like English Bob up into being, you know, like Jesse James or whatever.
Yeah, he's
English Bob is just a flea on a rat that's going by. You know, I mean, he's nothing. You know, so really, and it's great those scenes, for instance, where Gene Hackman is kind of deconstructing the myth that Saul Rubinek has written in that book that he likes to call The Duck of Death.
Yeah, that was
not
hilarious.
So, but the whole movie is really all about exploding these myths. You know, I love, for instance, the movie taught me one of the things that it taught me, you know, which I don't think I'm ever going to use, but because I've never picked up a gun in my life, but it taught me that it's incredibly hard to shoot a man. it's very difficult. It's much more difficult than it looks like in the movies or whatever, or whatever. You know, it's much more difficult. You've got to have a steely sort of disposition in order to do that. And I love how that movie, how Unforgiven, actually illustrates that very, very vehemently.
But I'm just thankful that Kevin Costner didn't do it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's self-aggrandizement, but Costner always said, you know, I had that script, I knew it was a good one, and I was going to do it. You know, I don't 100% trust him on that, but apparently Eastwood had the script forever, too. But and was holding on to it for just the right time.
Right.
Jerry, you think that's one? I mean, if you made a top three Eastwood, and I know you love Eastwood. I mean, that has to be.
Well, Before the Empty Chair, yeah. but I do like Eastwood a lot, and I think that's a good film. I think it's about time that the Academy, someone recognized him. I mean, because he's like the closest thing. I mean, he's a guy who does everything. And he paid attention to like Sergio Leone and Don Siegel and. Obviously,
He even dedicated Unforgiven to those two guys.
Yeah, and he loved, I mean, obviously must have adored John Huston, because I don't know if there's anyone alive who has kind of mirrored the career of John Huston, in a sense. I mean, he's just, his range is unbelievable. Unforgiven, and especially that year. Remember, that was a year of a lot of disappointing movies. Through the first half, and the summer turned out to be a bust, and then that comes out, and it was just like, wow.
That was like an August release, right?
Yeah,
it was the end of
you had that, you had Raising Kane, no, but that's good. I do like Raising Kane. But, you know, Unforgiven really was, like, one of the best films, and then, you know, later that year you had some other, you also had Howard's End, and Reservoir Dogs, and Malcolm X, A Few Good Men, Dracula, but, you know, Unforgiven was superb. There's no
Howard the Duck, 6 years earlier.
There you go, Howard the Duck of Death.
Well, Jerry, Glenn Ross was also that year.
That was
too.
A good end. You had singles that year, Glengarry Glenn Ross. You had a lot of really good movies in that fall.
But 92 wasn't the greatest year. That's funny.
Okay. So we'll come back tomorrow night and we'll bring you guys our number 5 through 1, and it should go faster because I think there's some repeats in here we don't have to rehash. At least on my list, I think there are. So thank you, guys. I'll talk to you guys tomorrow night at 10.
All right, tomorrow night at 10. Have a good night, guys.
All right, sounds good.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you.